Viv Richard swivels into a pool. And most times this happens, the pool disappears. The camera operator actually expects this and they whip towards the boundary, meaning that for a few moments, no one outside the ground actually saw the catch. After 27 balls, Viv Richards was on 33. The only thing that would stop him from a huge score would be the small Indian total. And then Maiden Lal bowled that short ball. The joke about Indian seamers, and specifically Maiden Lal, was that he ran in quicker than he bowled it. And when he delivered a short ball to Viv Richards, the game was at a pause, while the batter actually waited for it to reach him. I mean, maybe it's a little bit unfair to suggest it was that slow, but there is no doubt that Viv Richards had plenty of time to hit it anywhere he wanted. Out beyond the Lord's Square boundary, there is Abbey Road, the Abbey Road. There is a chance that Viv Richards could have hit a ball out there. And when he makes contact with this pull shot, you can hear a commentator, which I'm pretty sure is Richie Beno, say, "Shot." That is what was supposed to happen. A slow seamer bowl short and Viv murders the ball. That is why the camera moved out towards the boundary. And that is why you can barely see Kapil Dev turn at mid-wicket, take 18 steps, running at near full pace, looking back over his shoulder and easily take the catch. This is not a highlight take. It is certainly not one of the great catches in cricket history. Kapil Dev didn't do anything special from an athletic or fielding perspective. But this is the catch that changed cricket. Welcome to Double Century, the podcast about the history of cricket. This season, we are celebrating the Cricket World Cup. We will have an episode on every tournament so far. But for this episode, we wanted to look at 1983, which was the World Cup that changed cricket forever.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code PLAY100. That's code PLAY100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
First, I want to talk about a game that was not televised. Not because of a BBC strike, although there was one, which might have been part of the reason there was no news footage as well. But the main reason this game wasn't televised is that there were multiple matches played each day, and so in the old TV world, they couldn't all be televised at the same time. Also, because this was a match between India and Zimbabwe, and at that stage, no one really knew this game would ever be important. India had been a test nation for 50 years, but despite some great plays and decent wins, they had not really had a major impact on global cricket. And Zimbabwe, well, they had only even been in that name for a couple of years, and they were playing first-class cricket in South Africa, so no one saw them as a major side, especially not Australia, who opened the World Cup against them. Only John Tracos had played top-level international cricket from the Zimbabwean side, but that was in the 1960s, with South Africa. The Zimbabweans were terrified about facing Dennis Lilly and Geoff Thompson, but in truth, they're right at the end of their careers, and neither of them actually took the new ball. Zimbabwe grinded away in their innings and their top four all making double figures but not passing 50. There was a controversy with young Dave Houghton, the most talented batter in Zimbabwe at that time. He edged a ball behind and Rod Marsh took the catch, flicked the ball up in the air and then dropped his celebration. The standing umpire gave it not out, but Square Leg said it was. And for some reason, Square Leg's call stood without any discussion between the umpires. Despite all those starts, it meant that Zimbabwe were 94 for 5. But the lower order stepped up. Duncan Fletcher made 69, while backed up by Kevin Curran and Ian Butchart. It meant that Australia had to chase 240 from their 60 overs. Zimbabwe thought they had a chance to do well if they could just slow Australia down. Tracos aside, Zimbabwe did not have a particularly strong bowling attack. But Trekos was an off-spinner, and Australia had six left-handers in their top seven. His 12 overs would go for only 27 runs. At one stage, David Hookes missed four consecutive balls. But they also had Vince Hogg, who bowled in-swing, which of course moved away from the Australian southpaws. So his six overs only went for 15 runs. And he would have bowled more, but a back injury sent him off the ground. Meaning that almost a third of the overs that they needed to bowl were gone, and it meant that Australia had to chase at 4.4 runs from the other end. Those two actually didn't combine for any wickets, but their strangle was huge, as was the Zimbabwean fielding, which was absolutely top-notch, which meant that Australia could just not score freely. Graham Wood made 31 from 60, Kepler Vessels made 76 from 130, David Hookes 20 from 48, and Alan Border 17 from 33. Special mention should go to Graham Yallop for his 2 from 17 balls. When Rod Marsh came in, they were 146 for 4, but the scoring rate was already an issue, and that led to Australia quickly falling to 176 for 7, and that's when Rod Marsh just went for Zimbabwe. He hit his second 6 in the last over and bringing up his 50 from only 42 balls, but Australia lost by 14 runs. And to be honest, it wasn't until that last over that Zimbabwe actually thought they were going to win. Duncan Fletcher would end up with a 60 and also 4 wickets in what was an incredible effort. And if you'd like to know how big of an outsider Zimbabwe were, one fan had bet on them at 200 to 1. And while Zimbabwe had a very big upset, so did India. Coming into the World Cup, the West Indies had never lost a game in this tournament. And this was arguably on paper one of their strongest teams. Michael Holding, Andy Roberts, Malcolm Marshall and Joel Garner were their seamers. And it got worse for India when the match was delayed and they had to start batting on a damp wicket. But none of that bothered Yashpal Sharma, who made 89, while no one else passed 40, but it meant that India made 262 from their 60 overs, which was their highest total in a World Cup at that point. West Indies had a 49 opening partnership between the great Desmond Haynes and Gordon Greenidge. Those two were just starting to become the great opening partnership. But when they fell, there was a break of play, meaning that the game had to be restarted the following day. Viv Richards fell early, and India kept chipping away. Ravi Shastri and Roger Binney took regular wickets, ending up with 3 each, not to mention 2 runouts, so the West Indies collapsed to 157 for 9. But then Andy Roberts and Joel Garner put on an incredible last wicket stand. Garner averaged 9 in ODIs, and this was by far his top score, and he slogged the ball around for a while Roberts held up his end. As their partnership went beyond 50, you could imagine that India really started to worry. But Garner was finally dismissed by Shastri, and India took home the game by 34 runs after a 10th wicket stand of 71. But this was just a round robin part of the tournament, so India would actually play the West Indies again and lose their rematch as Viv Richards made 119, and Australia would beat Zimbabwe despite Dave Houghton's 84 in the following match. India had already beaten Zimbabwe as well, dismissing them easily for 155 and chasing it down at Grace Road. And on the same day that this second India-Zimbabwe game was going to be played, Australia were playing the West Indies at Lord's. Obviously, that was the game that was going to be televised. But also, you have one game at Lord's, and then India were playing Zimbabwe at Neville Ground in Tunbridge Wells. It is a club cricket ground that is occasionally used as an outground for Kent. It would hold around 2 or 3 first-class matches a year, and is a beautiful ground surrounded by rhododendrons. India were probably pretty happy to not have cameras at this ground as they dropped to 17 for 5 by the time Kapil Dev actually entered the crease. They recovered all the way to 78 for 7, but it still wasn't going to be enough against a disciplined Zimbabwean team. Now, this was not a knockout. At this point, all teams in their group had played 4 matches. The West Indies had 3 wins and they were pretty safe. Australia and India were tied on 2 each, but Australia had the better run rate. It wasn't net run rate at that point, it was just actual run rate. But with Australia playing the West Indies and India going up against Zimbabwe, a win would have put more pressure on the Aussies, plus it was a chance to get a run rate boost. So being dismissed before lunch was not any part of their plan. If India had lost this match, their chances of qualifying would have taken a massive hit. But Australia's last 2 games were the West Indies and India, so they had no games against Zimbabwe to get a safe win. The other thing is, though, if Zimbabwe had won this match, they would have pulled level with Australia and India on wins. But their last match was against the West Indies, so an unlikely victory for them. I know a lot of that is very confusing, but I'll try and make it as simple as possible from an Indian perspective. For India, if they had lost this match, it meant in the final game, they would have to beat Australia. And that is if the Australians who were playing at the same time lost to the West Indies. If Australia had beaten the West Indies, India would have to beat the Australians by a hilariously big margin. And considering they were 78 for 7, you could understand that the run rate probably wasn't going to be in their favour. It is really important to note, though, that real-time information about these sorts of things didn't really spread at that point. All India knows is they probably have to beat Zimbabwe and they probably have to beat Australia in order to qualify for the World Cup semi-finals. And at this stage, it doesn't look like they're actually going to make it through to lunch. But Kapil Dev was still at the crease, and he had two advantages. Zimbabwe had taken their quicks off, and there was a small boundary on one side. He wasn't really slogging, but playing correct shots and hitting them very hard. His 100 came up off 72 balls. He would end with 175 runs, 16 fours and 6 sixes. It was a world record and something that every person in India would want to see. But of course, no one would. Comedian and cricket raconteur Andy Zaltzman was one of the few people at the ground, but he was only a small boy, and he was more excited by his autograph collecting than actually Kapil's killer blows. So only a small amount of people in the entire world saw this thing that actually, in some ways, had an impact on a billion people. And I think what happens often with this game now is because we don't have any footage, people look back at it and they see Zimbabwe and they think this is easy. But they were a quality side and they played a lot of street smart cricket. And Kapil Dev hit them out of South England. The rest of India managed 79 runs while losing 8 wickets off 37 overs. However, the game did not end there. Zimbabwe still had to bat. And when Grant Patterson, the opener, was out with a score on 44, they collapsed. And when Fletcher was out, they were 113 for 6. But then another all-rounder came out to bat, Kevin Curran. And I mentioned him earlier. And if that name sounds familiar, it should. He is the father of Sam and Tom Curran, a county pro who took 600 wickets and made 15,000 runs. We never really saw the best of him when he played for Zimbabwe, but he certainly was a very skillful player who ended up with a 19-year professional career. And he only made 250s in one-day international cricket, and one of them was in this game. For the second time in this match, an all-rounder saved the day. This was more of a smart innings than just brutality, but Curran dragged Zimbabwe back into the contest before Maiden Lal finally dismissed him, and India would complete the Zimbabwe innings when Kapil Dev came back on for a caught and bowled. Of course, after all the panic, it didn't actually matter that much to Indian cricket's chances. Australia lost to the West Indies, so they still had to beat Australia to make the semi-finals, and they did. But to many Indian fans, that innings has a wider cultural appeal. Indian cricket had a bit of a timid reputation. And here was Kapil Dev absolutely playing as wild and as free as anyone else would in that World Cup. And the fact that no one saw that innings outside of a handful of spectators and a bunch of flowers means it actually ends up with like a mythic reputation. And some of it is not true. Kapil Dev didn't unlock something in the Indian team. They'd already made a really high score against the West Indians early in the tournament. But the brutality and the fact that it looked like they might be on their way out of a World Cup meant that this innings stayed around for a long time, and we're still talking about it now. And of course, we talked about the mythic nature of no one being at the ground and not having great details of the game. But there's also just something about the fact that Kapil did this without many people watching. And you're talking about a country of a billion people and they all have imaginations. And this innings is a dream innings, right? When you're asleep at night and you are dreaming about what you could do if you played for your nation, this is it. Save them from a collapse and go absolutely ballistic. I don't know if the rhododendrons would be there or not, but it's a very nice touch for a dream, right? But quite obviously, India's tournament didn't finish there. As I said, they beat Australia in the next game and they won their semi-final as well. And they made it to the final where, let's be honest, they slipped up and they only set 183. Only the dashing Chris Srikanth, one of the first real slappers in ODI cricket, made it past 30. The bowling lineup of Garner, Roberts, Marshall and Holding was simply too good. And only Garner actually bowled out his overs. I think everyone thought the West Indies, who had won the first two titles, would surely win their third without any real trouble. Greenidge and Haynes were opening up, and Greenidge had made more than this score at Lord's on his own and done it against a quicker and just better bowling attack and on a fifth-day test pitch with a limp. But India got Greenwich. And Haynes would finish his career with 17 ODI hundreds. One of those was 152 not out. He was a champion ODI cricketer, one of the first real anchors. But he was out too. And if those two were good players, well, Viv Richards was something else. If you drop Viv Richards' strike rate into modern cricket, he'd still be one of the best players ever. His current numbers are almost identical to Rohit Sharma. Viv scored quicker than anyone in his era, and he did it while averaging almost 50. He was the second leading scorer in this tournament as well. And of course, he had already made 100 against India. His reputation on its own was enough to chase this total down. But if you remember back to the start of this podcast, this is what we were talking about. Viv Richards at Lord's in a World Cup final facing India with a small chase, and he mishits the ball, and who runs over to catch it? Kapil Dev. And from that moment onwards, India's medium-paced militia were all over the West Indies, and they really never even got all that close to the chase. They would lose by 43 runs. India did not win a game in the 1979 tournament, and 4 years later, they were the champions of the world. And here's some truth. Kapil Dev's innings was not as important as remembered, and Kapil Dev's catch was not as magnificent as memory makes it feel. But what India did as a team in beating the best ODI team in the world, stopping their three-peat, and winning the World Cup for themselves changed cricket forever. India might have developed exactly the same way in cricket as it did anyway. There was always a love of the game before, but before it was quiet and respectful and about the game itself. 1983 gave India the best team in the world, and a billion people have been chasing that high ever since. Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version that you can get via Patreon, and there are many other extras involved with being a member over there. In fact, this show would not exist if Patreon members had not helped us at the beginning and continue to support us. Cricket history does not pay, so any help you can give will be massive. And you'll find a link in the show notes to subscribe. Remember to please review, follow, tell your friends and family, and just people that you meet in parties about our show. All of that helps us grow. Double Century episodes are written by either Abhishek Mukherjee or myself, sometimes both of us. And I am Jared Kimber, and this is part of my podcast network. The podcasts are overseen by Nick McCorriston, who also edits and produces Double Century. And C.S. Chuanza is our man for social media clips. If you like the Double Century podcast, on top of subscribing and supporting us, there's actually way more content like this on the Jared Kimber YouTube page.